You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 8:30, and we have in the studios with us once again Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning. How are you both?
I'm splendid.
I'm great.
Well, and I'm vigilant.
Splendid, great, and vigilant. Here we all are.
We're in a code yellow, as you know, based on the latest FBI warnings. So
are those warnings that tell us when the White House is about to do something, or are they less useful?
I wish.
We don't know. We don't know because they never give us details on it.
That's very true.
It could
be Rumsfeld this time. It could be Ashcroft. Could be any of them.
In fact, I was looking at the list of conditions, the things that they said made them wary, and I thought, geez, don't these operate all the time? You know.
Yeah, yeah. It's incredible. Anyway,
aren't these true all the time?
So
we have a lot this week.
We do. We have a lot. So let's just dive right into it.
Unlike most weeks,
election updates.
Yes. They're still counting the ballots. But an interesting thing came to light this week.
Didn't we deal with that in 2000? I mean, after Maria Cantwell and Slate Gorton and the national election, I mean, didn't we pledge that would not be a problem?
Yeah, that
again?
We'd
fix that.
They would count them faster. Well, no, they're not counting them any faster. In fact, there's still 4,000 absentee ballots to be counted. And here's an interesting fact I didn't know. There are 6,000 special ballots. Now, you're probably asking, what are special ballots?
What are special ballots?
Well, special ballots are votes cast by people who requested an absentee ballot but didn't receive one, and so they had to go to the polls and vote at the polls there. So that raises the question of, well, how many people requested an absentee ballot that were out of state or disabled who couldn't get to the polls? And isn't that a problem? And how come nobody is talking about that and nobody has addressed that? I think our King County Elections Director Bob Rogner really has some questions to answer about that.
That's scary.
And I mean, it really makes a difference. I mean, you're talking about 6,000 people at least who didn't receive their ballots before Election Day.
And right now, we're talking
about the monorail being ahead by only 329 votes. And we're talking about a very close race of Mary Fairhurst against Jim Johnson. She's ahead by 2,000 votes. But when you talk about 6,000 special ballots that haven't been counted, that's not very many votes.
Yeah, and although Fairhurst is ahead by 55% in King County, it looks good for her, which is a good deal. Johnson, if folks recall, is Tim Eymann's lawyer about many other things, and Eymann has a really odious new initiative out this week. But it underscores how important the King County electoral process is, not just locally, but to the entire state, because King County has a third of all the ballots in the state.
Yeah. So we should be making sure that there's an effort to get everyone a ballot and to get every ballot counted in a timely manner.
Yeah, I would guess that if there's 6,000 people that discovered they didn't get the ballots and came in, that you probably have an equal number at least that never bothered to come in.
And did folks notice that even though we don't know yet whether the monorail is going to pass or not, it's going to be very, very close because the absentees have been trending just a little bit against the monorail. They have already named the person who will direct the monorail effort should it pass. That is Joel Horn, the same evil genius who is behind to Seattle Commons vote behind. He was the right hand man for Paul Schell in the giveaway of the PacMed building to Amazon.com. I mean, this is actually a reason to root against the monorail passing. I think. I mean, he really is a not just a political hack, but really the wrong guy to be leading this for any number of reasons. Particularly when you're talking about a transportation system that involves right-of-way, involves all sorts of community development kind of issues and neighborhood development kind of issues.
Yeah, part of the business elite here of Seattle.
And the business elite who is very much dedicated not to sort of, grassroots public process.
Mm-hmm. Real quickly, you said something odious from Mr. Eymann.
Yes, he has a new initiative that he rolled out this week that is aimed for the fall 2003 ballot and will undoubtedly be on that ballot. He certainly has the machine for gathering signatures in place. It would require a 75% supermajority for any state, county, or local legislative body, city councils, county councils, anything like that, to pass any sort of tax or fee increase. There are no provisions for inflation. I mean, that's more of a majority than is required to amend the state constitution. And basically what it is definitely a long-term and maybe even a short-term death sentence for government in our state. It is a really, really frightening and sweeping initiative, yeah, much more so than ones he's put together in the past, and those have been damaging enough. And the question is, you know, how much is enough, and will there be, in fact, enough of a backlash to beat this one back? Because, you know, after 20 years of everybody, including politicians, saying that big government is bad, government is bad, government is bad, you know, there's been nobody out there beating the stumps saying that, you know, we pay taxes because we get services for them, and we need those services. We need roads. We need police protection and fire safety. We need a safety net for the less fortunate in our society. We need, you know, all these different things that really will be endangered in the long term and in many cases in the short term by this kind of an initiative. So that's an early warning that people need to start organizing against this.
That's if the courts don't throw it out.
Yes.
right now, Governor Locke and some other people have tried to get the courts to throw out the initiative that just passed, I-776. And it's becoming clear that none of the governmental entities in the state are going to pay attention to it. So King, Pearson, Snohomish County have not repealed their local option excise tax on
their
licenses.
There is a provision that says that initiatives cannot threaten the ordinary functioning of government, essentially, mm-hmm. that you can't have initiatives saying, let's abolish government. And Iman is coming as close to towing that line as he possibly can. I think that's the whole point.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of how much is enough, let's talk about the city budget and Jim Compton's soul searching that he did. This
probably didn't take very long.
No, it was an interesting week. The city council has been talking about the budget, even though. And nobody in the press really has been talking about the budget. But Nichols had, I think we talked about it two or three weeks back. Nichols proposed a budget that deeply cut into social services and programs for the arts in Seattle. And it was the city council's job to sit down and try to reconcile that with an uproar that occurred after Nichols released his budget, from particularly social service providers who said, look, you can't cut funds to community health clinics, you can't stop domestic violence programs, we need these community service officers that help so that the police can actually go out and deal with violent criminals rather than these like domestic violence issues and so forth. And so the city council has been trying to work out so that some of these services can be funded by making cuts elsewhere in the city budget or shifting funds around. And one of the places that they looked for additional funds was the one place that Nichols gave an increase in the budget, which was the money for the mayor's office. It was a 36% increase over last year that he had written into his draft budget. And social service providers were actually pretty good. They went to the city council and they said, can you just kind of cut that increase in half? They didn't ask them to just cut the increase out completely. Yeah. They just asked them nicely to cut it in half.
And this, just for context, this was to restore the grotesque level of funding that Shell had increased the office to mm-hmm. during his term. If folks remember, when Nichols first came in, one of his first confrontations with city council was because council cut the funding to that in last year's very tight budget. Well, Nichols submitted the budget that restored all of those cuts, he was cutting all these other things.
And added about a 6-7% increase over what Paul Shell had had.
Yeah.
So what happened was the city council has a budget committee, and the person who chairs that budget committee is Jan Drago. And during the week, representatives from the city council discussed with representatives of the mayor cutting the budget. And it seems that there was a little deal worked out to cut the mayor's budget by $90,000, which is far less than what I think or what social service providers thought was appropriate. And that's what was presented to the council in the general council meeting. And Judy Nicastro, thank God, challenged that. And she said, let's cut it at least $200,000. You know, and hopefully let's cut it $300,000 to fund these programs like the domestic violence program. And what happened was she had a majority of council people on her side. They voted to cut the mayor's office funding by $300,000. Well, what happened was reporters at that meeting saw that there were notes being passed back and forth, particularly a note to Jim Compton. Compton later in the meeting called for a revote, said he had changed his mind and wanted to restore that funding to the mayor's office. And he was backed up by Heidi Wills, who also suddenly had a change of heart. And a revote was taken, and it passed 5-4 to restore the funding to the mayor's office.
As opposed to the 6-3 passage for the previous deal.
Yeah, to restore funding to the mayor's office. And then immediately afterwards, Compton announced that that he had found funding for the fire truck at Green Lake, which had been cut out of the original budget. And now Richard McIver points out that was pretty mysterious. Well, reporters who were at that meeting were wondering about that little note that had been passed to Jim Compton before he had changed his mind, and they requested from the city clerk copies of that note. And here is what the note said.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, first they asked Compton for it, and Compton refused to release it. And so they filed, actually, I believe, a Freedom of Information Act with the city clerk in order to get it. It was not willingly given out.
Now, the note is from Deputy Mayor Tim Seiss. The note reads, "Jim, because of the council's vote on the mayor's office budget, we can't promise the money for Attack 16 now. Now, Attack 16 is what they call the fire engine at Green Lake. So here you have the mayor's deputy basically blackmailing Jim Compton to change his vote. And, of course, Compton, it didn't take him very long to figure out what he would do in that situation. He caved pretty quickly. What I can't figure out is why did Heidi Wills follow him? Heidi Wills, she was quoted as saying, "It's not worth war," which makes you wonder who
I
got to her.
I just want everybody to like me.
Yeah, who got to her? And if nobody did, then how come she can't take a principled stand on something like this? She seems to me she can't struggle for anything except maybe re-election.
Yeah, Heidi Wills really has not taken much of a principled stand. I mean, she's had a couple of good things that she's done in office, but very, very few. And, I mean, Jim Compton people have heard us talk about his performance on city council, particularly as chair of public safety in the past. But, I mean, you're talking about two of the less principled members of city council, in my opinion. And you're talking about Greg Nichols, a man who, you know, by all accounts, and Tim Seiss, his deputy, who has the reputation for being sort of his political strong person in the city hall.
Certainly was this time.
Yeah, Nichols is developing a reputation for empire building, something very similar, actually, to what we're seeing Bush doing at the national
level.
He's
turning out to be a bit of a bully.
Yeah. And if you recall during the election, when Nichols was elected running against Mayor Sidran, one of the knocks is that he might be too nice for the office. That is not turning out to be the problem.
No, it is not.
So what happened to the did the council do anything with the rest of the budget? Did they restore any of the cuts to
healthcare and stuff? Some of the things that they restored, they restored $1.6 million to the community health clinics next year, and then some more funds in 2004. They restored about $1 million in human services funding for small programs like the Community Voice Mail, for the North Helpline Food Bank, and some eviction prevention services and other services. They restored about $500,000 for the library's book collection. They restored four crime survivor services positions in the police department and six community service officers. They got $75,000 back into the car recovery clinic for low-income people who need to get their cars back when they've been towed. they managed to restore the fire engine at Green Lake, and we found out at what cost. So,
All right. Anything else on that?
Another nice thing about it all is that happily the city council was able to cut the $1.5 million to Greg Nichols' vanity sidewalk program. It was a new project he stuck into the budget when he sent it to the city council, was $1.5 million to build sidewalks in Seattle. And everybody pretty much scratched their head and said, "What? Build sidewalks? but no community health care? What's he thinking? And happily, the city council addressed that problem.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with sidewalks. It's a, you know, they're a good thing, but they're not the first thing
you
fund in a time when basic services are being cut.
Well, I think maybe he was thinking that that's where people would be sleeping once the shelters were cut.
Yeah, maybe.
We needed more sidewalk space. Moving along, let's talk about some type of scandal or further scandal with the California Power situation.
Actually, there's been a breakthrough in the California Power scandal. Williams Companies, one of the smaller energy providers that was involved in manipulating the market, admitted that it had manipulated California's newly privatized market, and they settled with the state of California and surrendered a bunch of documents, and a bunch of their employees testified. Now, Williams Company will pay California $147 million over 8 years. They'll reduce the current cost of their power contracts by $180 million and give California 6 generating turbines that are valued at $90 million. In addition, they're going to pay $15 million to both the states of Oregon and Washington for the hikes in power rates that we saw during that whole crisis situation. The great thing about this settlement is that it opens the door for settlements with the other energy companies that also manipulated the market, and that includes Duke Energy, Dynegy, Reliant Resources, and Murant Corp. And another great thing about this is that the documents and testimony by insiders at Williams Company has implicated these other companies, making a settlement much more likely with those four companies. Finally, I think the evidence in the case really proves that it wasn't the way that the privatization was set up that was the problem. It was the fact that they actually privatized the market, because there's evidence that the system regulators attempted to stop them from doing it, levied fines, gave them warnings, and that the company simply didn't heed that and just went ahead and did what they wanted.
And I got a very interesting email that I'm following up on this week from a gentleman who was involved in the setting up of the privatization scheme that our local utility company was participating in, as you know, Seattle City Light, and of course they've been much in the news lately for their mismanagement and, you know, what it
yes,
takes
indeed.
To get their what it takes to get their head guy fired, but apparently it takes an awful lot. But I mean, he was talking about how, you know, many of the people who set up these systems were trying to literally to construct them in a way that would minimize the abuses. They knew the abuses were going to take place, but that they were under so much political pressure that there was no way they could put, you know, that number one, there was no way they could avoid having to implement these schemes in the first place. But then also it was the political pressure that laid these schemes open and that made it impossible to design the systems in a way that would minimize them. So, I mean, you're really talking about political decisions that made these abuses possible.
Mm-hmm. And they were political decisions influenced by the energy companies themselves.
Very, very much
Pretty
so.
Much they designed the system, manipulated the system, and then when regulators attempted to use what tools they had at hand to punish them, they were unable to.
Yeah.
All right. Well, moving along, it's looking like the Office of Homeland Security is coming closer to realization.
Yeah, and it's been very interesting to watch the media coverage on it. A lot of it has focused on the reorganization of the federal departments. And even progressive media outlets like Counterspin are talking about things like the union rights of the civil servants and such, employees for the federal government. All those things are important. There's no question that this is a tremendous boondoggle in an awful lot of ways, that it does not actually serve Homeland Security very well. But there's even a larger issue that's being missed by a lot of this, which is it's very similar to the USA Patriot Act in that the devil is in the details. The federal government, or the executive branch, the Bush administration, was pushing very hard to get to get Congress specifically the Senate, the House has already passed this, to vote yesterday on Friday to pass this. The Senate, which is still controlled by the Democrats until the seat from Missouri changes hands, resisted it at least for a little while. So you've basically just got a few more days to contact senators and urge them to vote against this thing. They were only given 48 hours to read a document that's even thicker than USA Patriot Act. It's like 484 pages, something of that sort. And it contains an enormous variety of different provisions that accrue power to the executive branch, and specifically provisions that attack privacy. It enables these various departments to work together, but it also combines and greatly expands intelligence gathering data, enabling the federal government to access private credit ratings, employment histories, medical records. I mean, it's a tremendous attack on civil liberties, and that is something that is not being widely publicized in the debate on the bill.
Yeah, they're putting together a giant database on everything electronic that you touch.
Yeah, it really is quite frightening. And, I think there's the famous quote that privacy is a myth at this point. A lot of that information is out there already. But what we've seen certainly in the last year is that the problem isn't that there's a shortage of intelligence. And, depending on how you define intelligence, there isn't a shortage of information that's out there. The question is how that information is gathered, who it is gathered by, and who's interpreting it, because there's more information that actually than they can use. If the information is all centralized, all in one place, so that they type up the name John Smith or Maria Tomczyk or Mike McCormick into a database, and they get basically your whole life story, as well as who you hang out with, your friends, your purchases, where you've lived, where you've worked, whether you've had corns in your big toe. I mean, everything that could be needed really by a big brother type government. And that information then would be available to a wide variety of different federal agencies. The potential for abuses, and, we only need to go back to the last time this country fought in a controversial war in the Vietnam era and saw what the Nixon administration, which in many ways was even less power hungry than this one, the kind of abuses that they had with the kind of information that was available to them of these so-called enemies lists and so forth, and things like IRS harassment and that sort of thing was routinely used against domestic dissidents. The kind of information that's out there now to the federal government, particularly under this and under the USA Patriot Act and with the John Ashcroft Justice Department in motion, the potential for abuse is just tremendous.
All right. And running parallel to that, we have our current administration pushing closer to war with Iraq. I was somewhat amused to read Bush this week berating Saddam Hussein, telling him that he's not going to accept any deception, denial, or deceit.
Well, yeah, change begins at home. I mean,
from this current administration, you really have to take that one with a large grain of salt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, once again yesterday, you had U.S. and British planes patrolling the no-fly zones, having bombed after getting fired upon by Iraqi facilities in northern and southern Iraq. And as Counterspin mentioned earlier this hour, this is becoming one of the great bones of contention with the UN resolution, where the U.S. is claiming that firing upon planes in the no-fly zone will be considered a provocation under the resolution. Well, if you look at the wording of the resolution says that no hostile acts are to be undertaken against signatory countries in terms of acts that violate prior UN resolutions. Well, the no-fly zones actually are not a creation of a UN resolution. They were something that the UN, or rather that the US and Britain and France undertook unilaterally in 1991. France later dropped out, but the U.S. and Britain have kept it up. And the party line from the U.S. and Britain all along has been that these no-fly zones are building upon a previous U.N. resolutions, that they're meant to enforce U.N. resolutions, but that's not how the rest of the U.N., and specifically the U.N. Security Council, sees it. Well, now the U.S. is saying that, fly zone violations are a provocation for war. And this is something that is becoming increasingly likely that it will be that rather than the inspections, or that in combination with some or another pretext generated by the inspections, that is what the Bush administration will eventually use to justify an invasion.
See, I was taking it that at first I was kind of worried about that they were going to take that as a pretext, but then they backed off, and I think my suspicion of them backing off was because they didn't actually want to recognize the fact or have that come out in the media that it was, in fact, not a part of the previous UN resolutions.
Well, it depends who you listen to in terms of backing off. There is also a split within the administration on this. And once again, it's a split between the State Department and Colin Powell on the one hand and you know, the Wolfowitz and some of the hawks within the administration on the other. So it's very much apparently a debate within the administration as well. The trick is, you know, once you launch an invasion, it becomes a fait accompli, and, you know, you're into it, and the time for debate is over.
All right. Well, another country that we just recently invaded was Afghanistan, and there's some updates for that.
Yeah, this was the first year's anniversary of the Taliban leaving Kabul and the Northern Alliance troops marching in. And, you know, we could spend the whole half hour talking about what has happened in the last year and the lessons from it. I've got a column up right now working for Change.com that talks some about what has happened there and elsewhere in the region this week. You've got student riots in Kabul where a couple of students were shot dead by police. You have the interior minister saying that that's the first time that's happened in the history of Kabul, even if you take the last quarter century. That's a remarkable statement. They were rioting over things like, you know, no food, no water, no electricity, terrible conditions. There's been tremendous inflation in the last year.
The country's been promised $1.8 billion this year alone. The government's received about $80 million, and there are still ministers within the Afghan government who are throwing up their hands saying, where did the money go?
Yeah.
We haven't seen a penny of it.
Yeah, and the money that is going into Afghanistan is as often as not going into the pockets of ministers or the pockets of regional warlords. The Karzai government only controls the area immediately around Kabul, and even in that area, life has not improved that much for almost all Afghans, particularly the women. So, you know, there are certainly lessons there for the even more difficult task of what would happen if Saddam Hussein's government is driven out of power in Iraq. And you also have the incident this week, and, you know, we really don't have time to get into all these right now, but in Jordan, you had the Jordanian government sealing off the southern city of Amman and sending in troops there over what they claim is a matter that has nothing to do with an impending war. We just want to clean up the criminal element before the war starts. They found this huge cache of arms that Islamists in that southern city, which has a history of being sympathetic to Iraq, had been storing in the event of an invasion. And you have the sense that similar sort of caches of weapons are being quietly gathered in a region that certainly has no shortage of AK-47s and surface-to-air missiles and that sort of thing. In slums all over the Middle East and, for that matter, all over the Islamic world, the powder keg is not simply waiting to explode. The powder keg is preparing itself as well. And the United States is walking into something that would not just be a war within Iraq. They would become targets all over that region.
All right. And finally, there was a WTO ministerial.
Oh, yes. If you were like me and you broke into hives every time you heard any news about the Middle East, because it's becoming so much all Iraq, all day, all night, and all the next days, for 24 hours, it's Iraq and the Middle East. Go looking for other information. There was a WTO mini-ministerial in Sydney, Australia this week on Thursday and Friday. 22 nations, mostly the largest nations of the world, the U.S., the European Union, Japan, India, China, Brazil, and Australia, met to discuss two of the biggest sticking points in the WTO's agenda that actually relate to the poorest countries in the world. And those two,
even though they weren't at the table.
Even though they were not there at the meeting. And the two issues are agricultural subsidies by the richer countries, including the U.S., the European Union, and Japan, and access to cheap generic drugs to treat diseases like HIV, AIDS, malaria, cholera, and other diseases that are common in the third world. Now, this comes after a long campaign by South African AIDS groups to get cut-price drugs for South Africa. And drug companies are now terrified that these cheap drugs will eventually make their way back into particularly the United States, where the drug companies can charge whatever they want for these drugs.
And do.
Right.
And notably, and as Jav mentioned, most of the countries that these two provisions will affect were not at the table. So this is going to be a problem at the next major ministerial meeting when you do have those countries at the table. They're going to probably have to try to stop any agreement that was made in Sydney, Australia.
Have they mentioned which mountaintop or harbor or, you know, portion of Antarctica they're going to have the next meeting at?
I actually haven't looked for that information myself, okay. So I don't know.
All right. With that, we're pretty much out of time. There is one event that's happening today that we wanted to mention.
Yes, 2:00 at University Baptist Church. Is that correct?
Yes.
The gentleman you heard on the 7:30 portion of the show, if in fact you were up that early,
Doug Rocky.
Doug Rocky. Thank you.
former head of the Pentagon's depleted uranium program.
An expert on depleted uranium and its use and its effects, and a very, very good gentleman to listen to. Excellent information. Please go there. 2:00 UBC.
All right.
Well, that's at 47th and 12th Northeast in the U District.
Excellent. So, I think that's the same building that you guys are based in.
I know the address.
All right. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State, and very quickly tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found around town in bookstores, coffee shops, bars, all sorts of places where you can pick it up free. It's in the public libraries in a lot of places. And you can also find us online at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, or you want to volunteer, you can call us at 903-9461.
And for people who listen way up north, we do have some listeners up there, I know. I'll also be up at an all-day anti-war conference happening at Western Washington University in Bellingham today. We'll have plenty of copies with us and all that other good stuff, too.